Salutations, Mets fans, and welcome to this week's edition of Amazing Avenue Audio, the official podcast of your SB Nation New York Mets site, Amazing Avenue. I'm your host, Jeffrey Paternostro, and with me, as usual, is Rob Castellano. Rob, how's it going?
It's going all right. It's been better. Somehow I pulled my back running today, so I'm like laid low a little bit.
See, you're not 30 yet, but here's a little, I'll clue you in. Once you turn 30, your body just completely falls apart, so don't worry about it.
Yeah, I don't like this. I feel mortal.
Yeah, I have not hips. A fan. Like right when actually it started when I turned 29, I guess. That's hip, knees, lower back, neck, anything that has a joint. Basically, any place that two bones meet just starts to hurt.
Oh, I'm looking forward to the aging process.
Yeah, it's treating me well, God knows. So this is episode 48, and we've talked a few times on the podcast about bad numbers. I think episode 40 and episode 46 come to mind. And while those were bad, I don't know that they actually hold a candle to 48, Rob. And not just that it's like, oh, there weren't that many good players. You look at the list of Mets that wore number 48, and you just like get angrier and angrier as you read it off.
Yeah, it's not a banner list of names here. I mean, Ambriorix Burgos, a whole lot of who's that guy? Nino Espinosa, Ed Koopman.
The other Pedro Martinez.
Yeah. Pedro wore this number. How bad could it be? Oh, wait. The other Pedro
Martinez. Juan Berenguer. Pete Shurik. I have a soft spot for Pete Shurik. Pete Shurik and Eric Hillman. I thought were going to be, when I was 10, I thought were going to be like the stalwarts in the Mets rotation for years and years to come. It didn't work out that way so much. Actually, they're kind of both abjectly terrible.
Pete Shurik's name only rings a bell because I feel like he might have been one of those baseball cards that you always got.
Yes.
Like, just one of those guys that was in like every pack you bought and you were like, not you again, Pete Shurik.
Yeah, otherwise, he wasn't.
I have no memory of it.
Yeah, his 92 season, I think, suckered me in. But he had a pretty good season with the Reds. In 95, actually finished second in the Cy Young. Wow.
Oh.
Yeah. I don't think he probably deserved to finish that high. Let's take a look. It was a 4-win season. It was a nice little season. Let's see. It wasn't egregious. Greg Maddux, that was his 19-2 season with a 260 ERA plus. But, I mean, he was in the same general range as the guys that finished after him, Glavin. No, and so just the guys that got votes. There might have been somebody else. For the guys that got votes, Shurik was a credible second-place finisher.
How about Glendon Rush, who wore 48?
I almost gave him the episode title for this week because I had in my mind that he had one good playoff game for the Mets, like in my head for some reason, and that's just not true. I don't think he ever actually even started a playoff game. Maybe a late season game, and I don't know. But the title of the episode was going to be Glendon Rush had that good game that one time. But I don't know if that's actually. I mean, I'm sure he did, but not the game I was thinking of.
Yeah, he appeared in 6 playoff games for the Mets, but doesn't really look like any of them were that notable. He was always used as a reliever, which isn't always the way he was generally used with the Mets. And he had, I mean, he had that. What was it? 2000. He put up a 4.01 ERA in 30 starts. Useful.
Especially in that era.
Right, exactly. Glendon Rush. Then there's Pat Mish wore it. Frank Francisco most recently wore it.
But no, I think you might be able to guess out there in listener land. It's the Aaron Heilman edition. And not just the Aaron Heilman edition. We're calling it the Aaron Heilman was actually a pretty good reliever before he ruined all of our lives forever edition.
Yeah, he's just that guy who's almost around too long that he became the whipping boy. And obviously towards the end in those 07, 08 years where the entire bullpen just completely exploded, he was in the wrong place at the wrong time, certainly. But he was better than I think people remember.
So the podcast proper. I mean, I really could justify not having a podcast this week because nothing happened. But there's a little bit of news that's not really news we won't talk about. Then, on last week's podcast, we gave our hopes and dreams, our things we're looking forward to in 2014 for our last podcast of 2013. And now on our first podcast of 2014, we're going to look back at some of our favorite games from the 2013 Mets season. Logically, you would think we would have done that in the reverse order, but that would imply that we're actually good at planning things, like an agenda, for more than 1 week at a time.
And we obviously all know that that just
this, isn't... Yeah, that's if you've listened to even a handful of the previous 47 episodes on this podcast, you will know that's just patently false. And after that, we have your emails. We got a few of them. A bunch of them, even, I would say. I asked for your emails on Twitter, and I was a little worried that that might come back to haunt me. But there's a good variety this week.
They're getting cheekier.
They're getting cheekier, which I appreciate to a certain extent. Don't go crazy. And then we'll wrap things up. So it'll be a brisk, fingers crossed, podcast this week. We'll start with the news that's not news. So Ike Davis might be going to spring training now with the Mets. And we talked about this last week, and I made my feelings known on that. So here's, I'm unilaterally deciding this, Rob, so I apologize ahead of time, but I'm putting down a Mason Avenue audio policy for 2014. We are not talking about any Ike Davis news before position players report, unless said news is Mets agree to trade of Ike Davis.
I can get behind that. Despite the lack of democracy involved, I'm okay with it.
The other news, in quotes, is, the Mets continue to sort of maybe have dalliances with Stephen Drew and or his agent, but are reluctant to go more than 1 year. Again, we talked about this last week. We're like, since we're not news isn't actually happening after the podcast, but now things we talk about are kind of happening, I guess, after the podcast. We're like, yeah. Nostradamus of unnamed sources. Yeah. Maybe we are the unnamed sources.
We're certainly as reasonable as some of the others that I'm sure are being cited throughout this offseason.
And the last of breaking news, Taylor Teagarden agreed to a minor league deal with the Mets with an invitation to spring training.
Huzzah.
Huzzah indeed. So yeah, he can throw a little bit. He can hit okay in AAA. So he's just basic roster depth. Basically what Anthony Rucker was last year. They're kind of similar players. Though it does remind me of those glory days when the Texas Rangers had three top 100 catching prospects at the same time. And none of them actually panned out for the Rangers. Salty LaMacchia turned into a pretty good player for the Red Sox. Teagarden busted, as did Max Ramirez.
Yeah, I mean, good for Teagarden that he's salvaged a major league career, because way back when he was... What is it? Back in 05, he was drafted in the third round. If everyone remembers, he was like a star at University of Texas. I think he had a big College World Series and looked like he was going to be a stud catching prospect, and it just never really worked out. Early in his career, he looked like he might be like able to sort of fake it with the bat, but these last couple years with the Orioles, he batted 158 and then 167. With a pair of home runs each season. So he's not even faking it anymore.
Nah, catching prospects are tough. He'll probably be in Vegas, but he's not... I don't know that he's appreciably worse than Anthony Rucker. I mean, obviously, in the looks department, there's no comparison, but...
Yeah, and then he turns around, and then we have something to talk about.
Yes.
Talk about drop-off.
Yes. It's actually... I tweeted a little bit about Taylor Teagarden, just sort of... I half-assed a tweet at work about him. And somebody tweeted at me in all caps, of course, but what about his ass? I did an SAT analogy, which is Wrecker is to ass as Mejia is to hair. You just don't do comps like that. It's just not, you know, it's just silly. It's like, you know, comping a finesse righty to Greg Maddux. You don't comp a backup catcher's ass to Anthony Wrecker's ass. It's frowned upon in the scouting community. So I thought it was pretty funny, and not one of my best Twitter jokes. It was pretty funny. And it got, I think, a couple of retweets and a favorite. I saw the person that retweeted and favorited it. I just clicked on it because it wasn't one of my usual Twitter followers. And literally, her Twitter bio is fan of Anthony Recker's voluptuous, huge, curvy, round butt. And her location is up his ass, in parentheses, I wish. Now, the amusing thing about this, and she does follow me, apparently. Okay.
But I was going to say, otherwise, she is just like...
Well, I can imagine her doing a Twitter search for Anthony Recker ass.
At all times?
And, yeah, at least once a day. I couldn't see that on my phone. She does, in fact, follow me. So, hi, Trinity. But the amusing thing to me is when you click on it in the Twitter Mac app, you can see if she's followed by people that follow you and, like, you know, what your sort of, like, social links are. And one of my Twitter followers does follow her, and it's Patrick Flood, which I found amusing. But, yeah, there ain't no shame in having a Twitter account dedicated to Anthony Recker's ass, as far as I can tell. There's no shame in that.
No, I fully condone it.
So that's the news of the week. That's not really news. Now we'll move on to our 2013 retrospective. Talk about some of our favorite games of 2013. And despite a mediocre season, wherein the Mets played some games that, you know, made all of us want to kill ourselves, mostly against the Marlins, and games that just wouldn't end. They were a fun team in some ways. Like anytime Matt Harvey was on the mound, for example. But the first game that comes to mind for me, at least personally, is their May 19th game on Mother's Day against the Chicago Cubs. That was kind of, I was there live for this, it was kind of just a boring stinker. Until Carlos Marmol got into the game. And as Carlos Marmol was wont to do, he proceeded to give up a home run to Marlon Byrd and then a walk-off home run to Kirk Nieuwenhuis. It's also the game where Kirk Nieuwenhuis got pied with an actual pie.
Classic.
So there was a lot going on in this game. I think for me being there live, I was actually sitting down the right field line with a friend of mine. It was her first baseball game. She's from Kentucky and she dressed up like it was Derby Day, which was amusing to me. But I had a pretty good vantage point of Nieuwenhuis' home run. Like I said, the game was actually kind of boring, but I didn't get to as many games this year as I would have liked. Obviously, you know, wedding and honeymoon interfered with that to a certain extent, as did my minor league schedule, but I had a pretty good slate of games this year that I did get to, this being the most, probably my favorite one, certainly. And it was just a fun, walk-offs are great. I don't think I'd ever actually seen a walk-off live before.
Yeah, they are. For anyone who has not, it's a whole lot of fun. And obviously, you can't really plan it. It's just sort of you hope it happens and you get lucky if it does. But when it does, especially in a dramatic moment like this one, it's a lot of fun to be there for.
Yeah, just you could hear it hit the ball hit the Pepsi porch. Kirk rounded first, taking care of business, started up. It just you get like a bounce in your step when you're leaving the stadium. That's different from like a regular Mets win.
Okay, now, first dirty secret about this game. I think this took place on Father's Day, didn't it?
Did it? Did I just write down the wrong date? It's entirely possible I did that.
And it's hilarious that you transposed the two, but I'm pretty sure they were wearing, because I'm just pulling up photos now, and they're wearing the light blue armbands, which immediately to me makes me think that this was on Father's Day.
I thought it was on Father's Day, too, and that would make sense. It was right before I got married. So, yes, it was probably on Father's Day. I just wrote down the wrong date in my notes.
Regardless, it was on a day game in the middle of the summer dedicated toward a parent. Same idea.
Actually, I may have just... Did I just transpose to... I may have just transposed two of these dates. I don't know. But yes, so to all you parents out there, happy birthday.
Yeah.
The other thing about this game that I enjoyed is I still have a soft spot for Kirk Nieuwenhuis. It was nice to see him get his little moment in the sun.
Yeah, I agree, because that may be it.
It might be. He might. I mean, he'll be okay if they ever decide to reboot the Lorenzo Lamas series Renegade. They can totally do it with Kirk Nieuwenhuis. So, I mean, he has options out there. But, well, really just that one. But, yeah. I always, he was a small college Omar pick that I liked more than I probably should have. I probably should have seen him turning into a tweener but it's just he was a fun guy to root for.
Yeah, he was. I mean,
and I think it's possible that he was sort of an artifact of like he was a like one of the better prospects on Mets in a Mets organization that didn't really have good prospects.
Exactly. I mean, this is an Omar pick after all. So the fact that he was a prospect was a victory in itself, despite the fact that he wasn't really a great one.
I mean, yeah, like if Kirk Nonhaus came through the system today, he'd probably be like, he'd basically be like Jared King, who I also probably like more than most people do. So I haven't learned anything, but I also didn't rank, you know, Jared King in my top 10 or anything like that. So.
And Jared King doesn't have the hair of a Kirk Nonhaus.
No, but nobody does.
Well, I wouldn't say nobody.
Okay, well, nobody has that. I mean, nobody can really pull off that specific hair, I should say.
Like the flowing mane.
Yes, the flowing mane look. I mean, like, even like Nick Evans at his peak didn't quite pull that off.
Mike Nickias had some flowing hair.
Nickias was close, but it's like, you look at Nonhaus, you're like, is that a mullet? But no, it's not a mullet. But it's like almost unquantifiable.
Yeah. No, that was definitely some grade 70 at least.
Yeah, I'd hang a 7 on that. I don't have a problem with it.
Also he snapped an 0-for-21 streak with that home run, so it was, you know, that added oomph on that one.
I don't have the
after the game.
Yes. I don't have the box score. Was that a pinch hit? I can't even remember. If he came in as a defensive sub or if he, you know, it was a pinch hitting appearance.
I believe it was a pinch hit.
Yeah.
Which are even better. The pinch hit home runs are even more exciting than any other.
So second game, I'm trying to stick to games that I watched. So the Josh Satin walk off is disqualified because my phone died at bowling. You know, it was a great game, and that should. If I were going to pick a game that would be most likely to show up in Mets Classic in the coming years, I think probably the big ninth inning comebacks. They show that stupid freaking Cubs game with the ridiculous, like, 2007 lineup. Way too much. Where it's the same kind of thing, where they have a big comeback.
Oh, yes. What was that, Randy Wolf? Who was it?
Yeah, might have been. I remember... Jason Vargas started the game, and like Julio Franco played third, and like Ruben Gote was in there. Just like one of those,
right?
I think it was a getaway. It must have been a getaway day.
They show that one all the time.
They show it all the time. So I feel like this year's big ninth inning comeback could move into that role, because there's not really. I mean Harvey's one hitter. I imagine will end up there at some point too. But the Kirk walk-off, I mean, it wouldn't be a terrible one. It's just a boring game before then. But I guess the same can be said of the other big ninth inning comeback against the Cubs. And they show that all the damn time.
Yeah, generally it's hard to find a game that has, like, lots of action and, like, back and forth that ends as dramatically as one of these games. Because generally, you know, you're going to have sort of like a blowout or like a 10-7 game, which fun, but might not have that dramatic sequence at the end.
So our next selection is, this is kind of a cheat, but I don't care, and it's Harvey Wheeler Day.
Nobody's going to fault you for that one. No.
Actually, this is also kind of a cheat, because I had to follow the first game. It was a doubleheader. I had to follow the Harvey start at work, because I get to see Wheeler's debut. And it's just more for what it represents than the actual quality of the games, though anytime you can sweep the Braves at Turner Field, yeah, it's certainly worth the price of admission.
Oh, absolutely. Especially on a day like that where Wheeler lived, or Harvey lived up to what we had come to expect from him, and Wheeler sort of stepped forth as, you know, this very exciting number two where you sort of look at the future and are very excited.
They also have sort of the prototypical Harvey start where Terry Collins left him in a little bit too long and the bullpen almost blew it.
Yeah, there were a couple of those this year. Yeah. That was a fun day.
It was. It gives you hope for the future. I mean, I know Harvey's out all year with Tommy John surgery, but whatever. But it's just sort of like, if they can somehow make it so Syndergaard and Montero start a doubleheader this year, it'd be perfect.
Yeah. No, that was a good one. In total, 3 earned, 20 strikeouts, handful of walks.
That was because Wheeler, like, you could tell Wheeler was a little amped up. I feel like he walked two or three batters in the first, maybe he walked a few batters in the first couple innings and then settled down after that.
Actually, that was what was so exciting about that start, was that he kept walking guys at the wrong time. I mean, he had like six walks in the game, I think. And he kept walking guys at the time where it was like, oh, here it goes. It's all going to fall apart because, you know, we're all hoping for that scoreless outing, which he ultimately had. But, you know, there'd be, I think there was, I don't have the box score in front of me, but there was an inning where I think he walked two guys and there was an error in the inning. And I remember if it was Murphy or who made the error, but I remember never being so angry at the player, like, God damn it, not in Wheeler's debut. And he got out of it. And each time there were, you know, there was that moment where it was like, ah, okay, he's going to give up a couple runs here and that's okay. It's still just his debut. And he kept getting out of it. And at the end, it was like, whoa, that was awesome. Hopefully that's a sign of things to come. And, you know, the walks are definitely something he struggled with throughout the year, but it definitely sort of showed you something on that first day that there was something to be excited about.
The other thing that was especially notable about that start, to me at least, is it was very clear that he didn't have any command of his off-speed stuff, so he had to throw pretty much exclusively fastballs. And it didn't matter, because you could just watch it. And the Braves' center field camera is pretty good. And it just, the amount of movement on the fastball, you're just like, oh, yeah, he can just throw that as much as he wants.
Yeah. No, there's a reason why they only had four hits against him. I mean, that may have been up there with, you know, maybe one or two of his other starts as the day where his fastball just looked, it's very, very bad. He was clearly amped. He probably had more velocity that day than any other day, but it was showing.
No, the stuff was legit. It just, you know, it's kind of like a culmination of him, or of Sandy's plan for the team to build around young pitching. And there it is on display. That's how you do it.
Yeah. No, it actually, more than anything, it was really heartening because it showed you that this is something of a template now. I mean, obviously with Harvey, it went about as well as you could hope in terms of transitioning to the majors. And then after you saw that it's sort of working with Wheeler, with the knowledge that they've got a couple more guys, especially Syndergaard, that could potentially, you know, take the baton next year and beyond, it sort of makes you excited that, you know, they might have something figured out here and we might be onto something special. Obviously, like you said, Harvey's injury aside, it certainly validates the process and the plan that Sandy has set forth in terms of young power pitching.
And our third favorite game of 2013 is, of course, Yusmeiro Petit's one-hitter. No, I'm just kidding. I didn't see that either. If I had seen it, I probably would have shoehorned it in here, but I didn't see it. It's actually, we'll stick with the theme of young power pitching, and Henry Mejia's debut. I was going to cheat and do Henry Mejia's last rehab start for AA Binghamton against New Britain, which was indeed awesome. But he had better hair, I think, in his major league debut, so that's what I'm going with.
Yeah, that was sort of my intimation in saying that there are just a small handful of individuals who can boast to Kirk Nieuwenhuis about their awesome hair, and Henry Mejia is one of them.
I actually did get to see a little bit of this. I saw a decent chunk of his start, because I took a probably less than corporate-approved length of lunch to go to Buffalo Wild Wings, which is a mistake on several levels. But they do show baseball games, and they're around the corner from where I work.
Yeah, I mean, we've all had those days.
It's just, you got to do what you got to do.
I mean, there was a... Who was it? It was Harvey. It was a day game, and I was at work, and he hadn't given up a hit through, like, five. And so at this point, I have the little game cast or game day on MLB, and it's like the miniature version in the lower right-hand corner of my screen. So I'm still working. I'm not fearing any reprisal because no one's going to notice it. But it starts reaching a point where I had a meeting with my boss and a couple other guys, and someone mentions during the meeting, like, "Hey, Harvey's still hitless." And I was like, I pointed out to my boss, who she's a female, no interest in baseball, and I said, "I have to put this out there. There's something really important is happening right now, and I'm keeping just minor tabs on it. I just need to put that out there." And it was like one of those moments where the Mets absolutely superseded anything else, most importantly being my job, because obviously the hierarchy there is, you know, goes without saying.
I imagine at some point I will get fired from my job for something Mets related. If it were gonna break that way.
Oh yeah, I mean I'm certain that story would have ended that way had Harvey actually gone a little deeper. I think he gave one up in like the sixth or seventh, and so I was able to, like, you know, actually focus on what I was doing. But if it had gone any further, I'm sure I would have taken it into, like, you know, completely unnecessary territory.
Back to Mejia's start. He was just filthy, filthy, filthy.
Yeah.
There's nothing else to say about it. Just everything was working. The stuff, the hair. You're just like... And I had seen it the week before in New Britain, but it's just... It worked against major league hitters too, and he was great while he was healthy, and it's just a little bit of a tease for 2014. I know we talk about Mejia constantly on this podcast, and guess what? We will continue to talk about Henry Mejia constantly on this podcast.
Absolutely.
It's just not going to stop.
No, I mean, when he comes out and has a game like that, it was his season debut. The fact that he struck out seven was awesome, and the stuff was working. The slider looked as good as it ever had, and the changeup probably looked better than it ever had. But the fact that he didn't issue a walk in that game, that was the part that I was like, whoa, is he back? He might be back.
He was kind of back. And granted, that Nationals lineup was not particularly good at that point in the season, but still, major league hitters are major league hitters.
Yeah, absolutely. And I appreciated the game from him, because this was one of those days where twice throughout the summer I had driven down to Virginia, and this was one of the days that I was driving back. So, and both days, it's funny, I can sort of either end of the spectrum on my drives home. I happened to get lucky that on both rides back, there was a Mets day game on. So I'm pumped up, like, oh, this'll sort of keep my mind off the road. I can just sort of put it on cruise control and just listen to the game.
Which is going to be a thing that sucks about losing 660.
Yeah, no, right. That's a good point. I hadn't really thought about that. I mean, I never really sympathize as much as I should, because I have XM, so I always
have... Ah, yes.
But, and actually, you should have MLB at bat. That's
I do, but it's still, it's like something about the AM feed always appealed to me.
Of course. And so, in that instance, I'm pretty sure I was listening to 660. And a game like this is just, you know, this is driving gold. I mean, I'm a captive audience, going to be in the car for the next 3 or 4 hours. This is pretty much at the top of the list of what you want to be listening to on the way back. And probably the most exciting part was how excited Josh and Howie were, because, you know, it was sort of like this collective feeling of like, yeah, this guy was awesome in 2010. Whoa, is he back? Is that sort of fanfare and like that brief fervor over him in 2010, is that something that we should be bringing back here? Because he certainly looks like he deserves it. And, you know, the remainder of the season was pretty strong. Obviously, he had to cut it short due to the, what was it, the
bone elbow, chips, yeah
the elbow chips. But I mean, it certainly made you excited. On the other end, the worst thing you want to listen to on the way back is a Daisuke Matsuzaka game. I'll just leave it at that. It was one of the first few where he was just like ready to pitch himself out of the league, and that was like drive off the road sort of content.
I was driving back from North Carolina after my trip to Tennessee to see Kingsport. It's a long story. I don't think I've told it on the podcast. I don't really have time tonight, but I was in a bad mood driving from like the Raleigh-Durham area back to Brooklyn, and I was going to get in at like 4 in the morning, and I was listening to, it was the start, it was LaTroy Hawkins' blown save, the one where he got hit in the nuts on the comebacker.
I didn't actually see that one, so that's one that was sort of missed by me, but I know of it. I saw the replays.
And I'm, like, driving, like, through Maryland, barely awake, just, like, angry. Like, only have, like, anger keeping me going. I think it was a walk-off home run. I forget by who. That game obviously did not make the list.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I know the feeling.
I almost put the 20-inning Marlins game on just for the sheer, like, driving lunacy of it at some point.
Now, was that... I may have mixed up my bitter losses at this point. Was that the one where they came back twice in extra innings? I don't think it was.
No, it was the Harvey Fernandez game, and then Sean Markham pitched like seven innings or six or seven innings of scoreless relief before he coughed it up. Though I think they did. I think the Mets were up, as I recall. Let's look this up. The Mets were up 1-0, and then Markham gave up two to lose it.
Yeah.
It was like a harrowing. And I don't know why I stayed up. I think I actually had to be into work early the next day, too. And I stayed up. I did. I just stayed up out of pure spite. Like, I knew how it was going to end. We all knew how it was going to end. I'm just like, you know what? F this game. F everything. I'm going to eat my goddamn ice cream and watch this horror show. That's what I did.
Yeah. Those are definitely the most bitter of the losses when you commit. And it's like, you know what? I'll stay up. That's fine. I'll be tired tomorrow, but reward me for this. Don't let me down here.
Oh, I knew for a fact there was going to be no reward.
Yeah, it's sad that, I mean, when you're going down that path and you know it's going to end that way, that's just true desperation sort of territory.
No, yeah, I'm losing my mind. It actually wasn't. It was actually in, for some reason, and the Marlins and Mets played many, many terrible games this year, a lot of which went to extra innings. But this one was actually in Citi Field. And it was just they just coughed it up in the 20th and couldn't get it back. And of course, they were rewarded for keeping Steve Cishek out of the game long enough to get the save situation.
Okay, yes, I do remember that. You know what, I was thinking of the 4th of July game, that's what it was.
There were a lot of just horrible. Yeah, that was the Diamondbacks, wasn't it?
It was. 4th of July game.
I watched that one. I just got back from my honeymoon. I just watched that angry on my couch, too.
Ooh, that's a rough one for, like, a first getting back to the Mets sort of game. I mean, it was exciting.
Well, I mean, let's not kid ourselves. I was definitely listening to some games on my honeymoon. Because it's me.
Okay, well done. That was the one where Anthony Recker solo home run to tie it in the 13th, two outs. Kirk... solo home run to tie it in the 14th, I think maybe with one out, but still exciting. And then they drop it in the 15th because there were just no more competent relief pitchers.
It was reminiscent of that game a few years ago against the Giants when they had back-to-back, and it was back-to-back two-out home runs from Valentin and Millage to tie it, I think. And then they went immediately blew it in the top half of the next inning.
Ooh, that one escapes me, but I'm sort of glad, it sounds like.
I think that was the same. I think it might have been the same one where Brian Bannister got injured. Maybe it was 2006. It must have been 2006. I think it was the same one where Brian Bannister got injured early on, like tore his.
I do remember that one very well. Okay.
I might be conflating two separate games, but that's certainly possible. I have not done the requisite research.
Well, you got me thinking that on my honeymoon, I convinced the wife to. We did like a West Coast tour, and by coincidence, we ended up in San Diego the same weekend that the Mets were there.
By coincidence.
By just some magical touch of fate. And so I convinced the wife to get out to the game. And I knew I had pushed my luck when, like, just a few rows away, Kevin Burkhart was doing his, like, mid-game update. And I was like, oh, shit, that look, it's Kevin. I got to go say hi to him. I wonder if he knows of Twizny. He'll probably hate me, but I have to bring it up. And so, like, I'm like, just wait here, honey. I'm going to run over there, see him. He's not that far away. And she just gives me the look like, you've probably pushed it far enough. Don't push it any further. And I was like, are you sure I can't go? And she was like, go if you want.
Oh, yeah. I would have. See, I would have done it.
Yeah. Looking back, I wish I had. But I was like, ooh, don't want to get things off on... too much of a... I mean, I'm already off on the wrong foot. but let's not double down here.
I convinced my wife to go to an MLS soccer game on our honeymoon. And then it gets better. Bought the tickets thinking it was Sunday when it was really Saturday, and went there Sunday to their field. There was nobody there. She was not happy. So I failed on several levels there.
Yeah. Although, you know, she may have actually like, secretly been happy she wasn't going to have to sit through the game.
Yeah, probably true.
Still, I think you probably lost a number of brownie points just in dragging her out there.
Yeah. So those are that's our 2013 season in review, guys. We'll never talk about it again. RIP 2013 Mets. So now we'll move on to your emails. As always, you can email the podcast at podcast@amazonavenueaudio.com. And our first email this week is from Tom. This is our second email because he actually put in a quick follow-up for clarification. Hey guys, love the podcast. Thought I'd drop a line and suggest a trade deal, Fantasyland style. I'm doing this again. No, I'm not doing it. I'm doing it right. Okay. By the way, my first Mets memory... I always fear because of the way my email saves multiple emails from people that I'm like reading emails from 6 months ago, which I have done, as we know. By the way, my first Mets memory was 73 World Series controversial play where Buddy Harrelson was called out at the plate. I think he was tagging up, but I'm not sure. Anyway, this should make both of you happy that someone is older than you. I know they're out there. This isn't like Logan's Run. I think I'd be dead, actually, if it was Logan's Run. Here's my scenario. And the fact that I referenced Logan's Run probably speaks to how old I am. Here's my scenario. You have a crystal ball that shows a team that has four players you can trade for that will help the Mets reach the postseason five times in the next 8 years. It also shows you that if you don't make the trade, the team will make the postseason two times in the next 8 years. The ball does not show you the outcome of any of the postseason appearances. The catch is that to get the four players, you have to include David Wright in the deal. Do you make the trade? And his follow-up is, let's assume Wright will be around with the Mets for those 8 years via a new contract a la Derek Jeter. I thought about having the Mets make the postseason once with Wright, but winning the World Series and the five postseason appearances without him being unknown. Let's keep it as literally written. Thanks, Tom, who is Nystrom on Amazing Avenue. So I like this. This is a nice little fun hypothetical here, I think, the way it's laid out.
Yeah, I like the thought experiments. We've been getting more of them lately, and I will definitely condone them and encourage more.
So let's first, again, I'm going to unilaterally, once again, declare the Amazing Avenue audio policy on David Wright. We like David Wright.
Yeah, once again, I'll condone it.
And I mean, I think there's something to be said, certainly, for like the idea of the Hall of Fame player that plays his whole career with your team. You know, probably even this scenario, Wright still goes into the Hall of Fame as a Met, yada, yada, yada. But it's just something, you know, that the Tony Gwynns, the Cal Ripkins, my mind's starting to blank because, of course, it is Barry Larkin. You know, guys like that, there's something, you know, to that, that I think there's maybe like some extra surplus value.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, sort of that, like, the soft value. I mean, it's not like they say banners wave forever and all that, but, you know, there's value beyond just banners and World Series rings, and, you know, it's hard to argue that too much, but I think this is one case where you can make that argument where a player like that, I mean, in some cases, that player is more rare than a World Series and is actually harder to come by than a World Series.
No, there's certainly something to be said for that. And I think, I mean, I guess Gwynn didn't win a World Series when he was in San Diego, but it's still the connection between Wright and the Mets fan base should go beyond, you know, maybe players, like lesser players, in terms of their Mets career at least, that won titles in Queens. But I don't know that always actually happens. In a lot of cases, the relationships are made by, you know, at least playoff appearances, if not World Series titles. I mean, guys like, you know, Keith Hernandez, Ronnie, Gary Carter weren't as good as Mets than Beltran, Reyes, and Wright, for example. But, you know, also in all three of those cases, I don't think that, I mean, Darling was drafted by the Mets, but Carter and Hernandez obviously started with other teams. In fact, teams that were rivals of the Mets in that era. And I think there's a connection to the fan base because they were on those title-winning teams that maybe Beltran, Reyes, and Wright don't have, even though they were better players as Mets. I think the same is probably true of Alfonso and Piazza, who didn't win a World Series but came close and made the playoffs multiple times. I think so. Let's delve into this scenario. If the Mets, you know, the playoffs are a crapshoot. You want to get there as many times as you can. You want to get as many tickets to the lottery as you can get. So if, you know, maybe out of those five appearances, you get a World Series win out of there. And in that case, wouldn't you just, here's my hypothetical, wouldn't you like end up just having the connection with, you know, say Daniel Murphy, Zach Wheeler, and Juan Lagares? You know, Daniel Murphy becomes Wally Backman, and 25 years from now, we're arguing about whether Daniel Murphy should be the next manager of the New York Mets.
I can see it actually.
Yeah, you know, Lagares becomes Mookie Wilson. And even if those guys, not end up, Murph leaves in free agency, Lagares is just kind of, a fringy second division starter, but he has some big hits in the playoffs. Or, Murphy has like a walk-off hit. Wheeler wins a game seven and then blows out his arm. I think maybe they aren't as good as Mets. This guy, again, I'm going to use Beltran, Reyes, and Wright as sort of the most recent examples of this phenomena. But I think there's a connection there that's not, look at the reception guys like, and again, some of it's nostalgia, but the reception that guys like Mookie Wilson and Edgardo Alfonso get when they come back to City for whatever, whether it's a Hall of Fame induction or something like that.
Yeah, I think I'm with you on that one. I'm like doing the math here. So we go five times without Wright. We go twice with him.
Yes. I mean, anything can happen. Like I said, the playoffs are a roll of the dice. The other thing to factor into this, Rob, is so here's the thing. I want a goddamn World Series title.
Yeah.
I started cheering for the Mets in 1987. So that's where I am at this point in my life.
Yeah. No, you're right. I mean, on the one hand, it's like, well, what if they don't win after those 5 years, and then you feel like an idiot. But then on the other hand, you don't want to be like the. I mean, at this point, I'm not 30 yet. I can say like, hey, I got plenty of years.
Yeah,
Let's
way
hold
to
on to.
get to the other side of 30 there, sport.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe in a couple of years, I have a completely different outlook, and I'm like, hurry! I don't have much time left. But like, that's exactly it. You don't want to be like the 94-year-old guy who it's like, yeah, I'm a Cubs fan. I'm probably never going to see it happen. It's okay. I've come to terms with it. You don't want that to happen. So
No.
on the other hand, it's like, give me as many shots as I can as soon as possible.
No, you don't. But at the end of the day, my stance on this is fuck it. Give me David Wright for 8 years. I think if you, something about baseball, if you root for a team solely to see it win a World Series, hi there, Yankees fans, and especially a baseball team, where like the thing about baseball is sort of the day in, day out relationship with the players, the broadcasters, the media even. It's just so intrinsic to the sport, that kind of like, deep relationship. There was just not, I just don't see the appeal of like, oh, my team didn't win a World Series. I just want to win a World Series. Like, I get that we're rooting for laundry and whatnot, but, I want to hear Howie Rose call David Wright's walk-off home run in like game five of the NLCS. Like, just that's like that kind of like, I can like, you can just feel it. Like, I say those words and it's like, there's like a sense memory that, a memory doesn't really exist. I forget what the term for that is. Presque vue? One of the press, it was one of the vues. It's not deja vu, but it's like, it's just, I can picture it, I can feel it, I can hear it in my head. It's just, that's what I want. I want, even if it doesn't happen, it's what I want.
Yeah, I think you're definitely onto something with that because, I've said on the podcast before, I'll point out that I'd rather lose with my guys than win with some other guys, and to a degree that's stupidity and I'm wrong,
But
but.
I don't think you are. I mean, you kind of, I get why. Let's put it this way. I don't want to hang out with the person that vehemently disagrees with you on that point.
Agreed. And you know what? I don't think our listeners do either. I mean, we're talking to a bunch of Mets fans who are listening to a podcast about nothing for the most part on the middle of January. So I think for the most part, I think people agree with you at this point. The Mets fans who don't are the ones who probably aren't even Mets fans yet. And come July when the team is on a miracle run, suddenly those are the new Mets fans who, of course they're going to be on the bandwagon, but the ones that we're talking to right now, I think will agree with us that David Wright is he's a commodity that you really don't come across often, and you really don't want to give it up almost at any cost.
Shorter podcast. David Wright is ours. You can't have him.
Okay.
Our next question is from Andrew. Hey guys, by the time most of us hear this, Tom Glavine will be the 12th former Met going into the Baseball Hall of Fame. Yeah, maybe. I'm gonna try to get this up before the Hall of Fame vote is announced. We're recording this on Monday night. Barring a surprise surge by Piazza, it'll be close, and that makes me angry. It makes me so angry. All of those except Seaver will be in with non-Mets caps. So how would you rank the 11 former Mets in the Hall based only on their Mets careers? He goes off to list them, and it's Yogi Berra, Warren Spahn, Willie Mays, Duke Snider, Richie Ashburn, Nolan Ryan, Gary Carter, Eddie Murray, Ricky Henderson, Roberto Alomar, and Tom Glavine. Thanks. Figure it should give you something to talk about for a bit. Big fan of the show, Andrew. It's actually pretty easy. I mean, I think Glavine, of course, and Gary Carter are probably clearly the best there. They're the only two that made my top 50 Mets of all time list. Carter, a fair amount ahead of Glavine, though maybe not as high as you would think. And it's a lot of those guys are like, and we've talked about this on the podcast before, like the early 60s. Hey, these guys used to play in New York City, nostalgia players that the team brought in when they were just terrible. Yogi Berra, Warren Spahn, Duke Snider. I guess I'll throw Mays in here too. It was a different team, obviously, but it's the same kind of player at that point in his career, even though the team itself was much better. You've got one just playing past their prime Hall of Famer that wasn't from New York and Ashburn. You got Nolan Ryan, who I don't not entirely sure what to do with. Roberto Alomar, moving on. And Murray and Ricky Henderson, both of whom I love but don't think of as Mets per se. Though I guess both were, I mean, Henderson's 99 with the Mets is like kind of like a sneaky good season. And Murray was all right, though past his prime at that point.
Although, speaking of sneaky good seasons, his 93 batted 285, 27 home runs, 100 RBIs.
And he gets killed because I think defensive metrics don't like him at first at that point. But yeah, it was like a. I love Eddie Murray. I love his facial. I always, as a kid, he was one of my favorite players. It
You
might
nailed
have.
with the metrics, by the way, because he, after the 27 home runs, 285 average, on base is fine at 325. He's a 1.1 war. That is that possible?
First base is tough too. I mean, it's not like it was a. It was 93, one of those fluky good offensive years. I think before that, I don't even know.
It must have been like
I'd
the
have to
opposite
dig into
steroid.
the numbers, but I remember because I've looked at his Mets page before. They don't. He didn't have a great season with the Mets, even though I do remember that 27 home run season fairly well. And probably because I stared at the back of his baseball card a lot as a kid.
But the point remains, definitely past his prime, sort of washed up Met.
Yeah. So I don't know, it feels like there should be more. I mean, there's no. That's actually a really, really good crop of Hall of Famers. And just like if you were to pick, I don't know, any other team, especially a team that young, I don't think you'd necessarily get just, again, not guys that were very good as the Mets, but Spahn has an argument for being one of the 20 greatest pitchers of all time. Berra's probably Berra Bench are the greatest catcher of all time. Willie Mays has a case as one of the five greatest players of all time. Snider and Ashburn were both easy Hall of Famers. Nolan Ryan's probably a little bit overrated, but definitely a Hall of Famer. Carter's a top five catcher of all time. Murray's more of a, I forget where he, I think he's right about average on Jay Jaffe's Jaws metric. Ricky Henderson, top 10 player in baseball history. Alomar, one of the 10 best second basemen ever, maybe top five. So, and even Glavine, who's not, he's going to go in this year probably.
Oh, he's just apparently, according to the early reports, he's a slam dunk. He's like
Which is
a.
a little, I mean, I guess 300 wins is 300 wins. Is
I
what
was
it comes down
surprised.
to. I'm a little surprised. And don't get me wrong, I think he's a Hall of Famer, but I didn't think he'd quite. Maybe it's just like a Maddux. I wonder if he would have done as well on the ballot if he was on it without Maddux being on it too, in a weird way.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I think that sort of symbiotic relationship they had going, where they sort of fed off each other, definitely helps in terms of like reminiscing about these guys and letting them sort of go in together.
But while it's a great class of Hall of Famers for a team to be able to claim representation, I don't know, feel like, I don't know, it feels like the Mets should have more like Mets Hall of Famers than they do. I mean, I guess you could argue Carter could have gone in as a Met. I think he was very clearly better as an Expo.
Yeah.
And there's certainly some politics involved, too. It allows him to get, like, an Expo in the Hall of Fame since the team doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
And I imagine Reigns, when he gets in, will go in as an Expo, too. But that was certainly far from a slam dunk when Carter was. I think it was... I don't think he was... He might have been still playing when Carter was inducted, actually. Maybe not, but I can't remember how long he's been on the ballot offhand. Assuming he does get in, I assume he'll go in as an Expo. I just feel like, you know, I mean, Kuzman, I guess, didn't quite have enough of a gentle decline phase. You know, Doc and Darryl, we know what happened there. You know, Olerud wouldn't have gone in as a Met, but I just think of John Olerud as a Met because it makes me happy.
Granted.
Same with Keith. It feels like they have a lot of borderline. Even David Cone, it does feel like they have a lot of borderline type guys kicking around in there.
Yeah, which sort of goes back to our prior point that those slam dunk, you know, iconic players that are linked to your franchise forever are very valuable and very tough to come by.
I mean, when you really think of like Mets, players that were like Mets, bold, all caps. I mean, Seaver, Kuzman, Gooden, I mean, like really good players. Steven, and I mean, not necessarily Hall of Famers, but, you know, Hall of Very Good guys at least. So Seaver, Kuzman, Gooden.
I think Strawberry's got
Strawberry, certainly.
Piazza gets in there.
I mean, yeah, you know, when he gets in the Hall of Fame, he'll probably go in as a Met, but it's certainly more evenly split than a lot of those other guys.
Yeah, true. As far as, you know, awesome players who did their best work with the Mets, he's probably the closest to the cusp of any of the guys we've named.
I guess, I mean, I'd put Fonzie in there, but he can't even make the Hall of Fame ballot, so whatever. And then, you know, David Wright, really. And probably Beltran, I think, will fall into that Piazza group where he did his best work with the Mets, but it's like a plurality.
Yeah, certainly.
And Reyes, it's probably too early to tell, though I imagine he'll fall into that group as well. Sort of the Piazza-Beltran group where he did his best work as a Met, but there's, you know, other teams that get consideration.
Yeah, it's an interesting question because the Mets do have that sort of strange, anomalous situation with a lot of their former players, or, you know, lack of former awesome players. And so this group is an interesting one to look at. But yeah, sort of a lot of bummers in there. That's just about the best way I can describe it.
Our next email is from Carrie, and his subject line is shortstop, and it's not about shortstop, so I see what you did there, Carey. Well played.
Very clever.
Seeing as how rosters are somewhat settled, how are you two expecting the division to shake out this year? How much of an impact are you expecting moves like the Nationals stealing Fister and the Braves losing McCann / not being able to lose Ugla to make? Best, Carey in New Orleans. Now, we'll do our proper division previews closer to opening day. We'll have our SB Nation cohorts on like we did last year. I'll try to get all the divisions this year. But I don't I feel like at least going into the season, 2014 kind of feels like a copy of 2013 with the Nats sort of as presumptive favorites again. The Braves counting on young pitching and three true outcome hitters. The Phillies kind of stuck in no man's land even with their ridiculous new TV deal. The Mets sort of treading water, you know, getting good value in free agency, but basically just replacing what they're going to lose with Harvey and the Marlins, whatever. I don't care about the Marlins. Though I will say, if you were going to be, if you were a snarky beat writer who wanted to write a pithy tweet about the Mets being worse than the Marlins this year, this might actually be the year to do it. Because I could see, you know, I could see a scenario where a Mets arm gets hurt or some of their older free agent signings underperform or get injured, and guys like Christian Yelich and Marcelo Zuna take big steps forward for that team. Not like, you know, they win like 74 games or something. So if you were a beat writer that wanted to do a snarky tweet about the Marlins being better than the Mets, this is probably the year to do it, not last year. Just a heads up.
Yeah, I agree. I think this year will be sort of similar to last year. And I don't buy in on the Marlins, so I think we're safe to sort of maintain our hierarchy above them, but sort of still behind the rest of the division. And I mean, my sort of one point that I'll make going into 2014 is that I don't buy the Braves. They were too much of a team of extremes last year, where it was like all or nothing. They didn't hit lefties at all, but they, you know, hit a ton of home runs against righties, and they struck out all the time, and they were just so like completely spastic that I could just see them falling off a cliff, at least offensively. I mean, their pitching staff was really, really strong, will probably remain so, although I think the loss of Tim Hudson hurts, because he was just he's always has been like a stabilizing force for them. And I mean, he, you know, missed third of the season, if not more, after, you know, the injury in the game against the Mets. But I think that'll hurt him. But more than anything, their offense scares me. So I could see them dropping off pretty good this year. Agreed that the Phillies probably won't make huge gains, but yeah, sort of similar to what we saw this year, I would say.
Yeah, I think with the Braves, their offense was propped up a little bit by Freddie Freeman and Chris Johnson hitting 320 last year. I don't necessarily see that happening again. But I guess I could see it offset by B.J. Upton being a little bit better, because really he couldn't be any worse. And losing McCann hurts. I don't buy into Evan Gattis as an everyday player. You know, he's neat, he's strong, he doesn't use batting gloves, he has a weird swing. But I just don't, guys like that, I think they get exposed with more playing time. I think he'll be a useful bench piece for a guy who can catch and whatnot and play a little corner outfield very, very badly. But I just, something about that team just doesn't, I mean, they'll be fine, they'll be in the wild card race, I think. They're like a 86 to 90 win team to me. But they don't have a ton of help coming on the farm. At least not like next year. And somehow the Nats got Doug Fister. God damn them.
Yeah. No, they can certainly right the ship this season. I wouldn't be surprised if that happened. But yeah, I think generally we're not going to see a huge shakeup in the division, I wouldn't say.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely see the Nats getting some positive regression this year from a few players of Anthony Rendon for a full season. They have, you know, they have the financial flexibility and a few prospects left where they want to go out and make a move. They can make a move at the deadline. They need to shore themselves up. Again, I'm terrible at this game, prognosticating and whatnot, so I'm just going to keep it fairly. I'm not going to predict anything crazy.
Yeah, agreed. I won't really put anything out there. Aside from my one comment that I think the Braves are going to take a big step back.
You're not buying the Braves, all right.
I'm off on the Braves.
I see. I'll make one a little bit out there prediction. You can decide how out there that is. The Phillies will trade Jonathan Papelbon, eat a ton of money, and then sign another closer for too much money, but fewer years.
And
say Grant Balfour.
I mean, and sadly, that's not really going out on a limb.
I know. I don't know if it qualified as going out on a limb.
That's just like, guess what Ruben Amaro will do next.
So this is obviously, there's still, I mean, there's a decent amount of the offseason left to go. There's still a lot of a lot of free agents out there. You know, when you know something crazy. I mean, could the Phillies sign Tanaka? Sure. I mean, crazy thing. They have the money, obviously. Now, you know, crazy things could still happen. As it stands right now, I'll say, oh, Nats win 93, Braves 88, Phillies 83, Mets 76, Marlins 68. There you go.
Yeah, I'll sign off on that, although.
I know you're less high on the Braves, which is fine. I
Exactly.
don't think you're necessarily wrong.
We'll get into that proper
Yeah, we
later
have
on.
a lot of podcasts. There's a lot of podcasts between now. Sadly, just too many podcasts between now and the start of the season. But
Wait.
we'll have content for it. Our next email is from Philip. Hey guys, the rumored negotiations of Davis, Duda, and Murphy for Eduardo Rodriguez and prospects doesn't sound like it makes much sense. Could this be a potential trade? And if so, who would play first with those three guys gone? Thanks, guys. Keep up the awesome work, Philip. I haven't heard this per se. I think maybe Philip might be combining multiple trade rumors.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. Because he's right, it doesn't make any sense.
Have no trade all the first baseman, but I mean, I think it does bring up the question of who is the first baseman of the near future. I mean, Dominic Smith is many, well, not many, but several years away. And it does seem like you can, find a first baseman on the market late in any given offseason. This year it's probably going to be Kendrys Morales. I mean, obviously the Mets thought Ike Davis was their first baseman of the future as recently as 2011. Maybe as recently as the 2013 spring training, to be honest with you. So him missing is kind of a problem because you don't, I don't know, it's tough to develop first baseman. You just get guys to hit and they kind of can't play anywhere else. Like Lucas Duda, who doesn't really quite hit enough, at least so far from what we've seen in his major league career. And Murphy, yeah, he can play some first if he hits 310, basically. So I don't know. I don't have a good answer for who the first baseman of the future is.
Yeah, I mean we've sort of beaten this one to death, so it's hard to really say what's going to happen. It's sort of interesting though. We hit on this a little last week that Sandy still is sticking with the top pitching prospects and really not backing down because Eduardo Rodriguez, that's pretty much a top five prospect in the Orioles system. That's not just, some guy. He's
Yeah.
an interesting arm.
Close to the majors, will probably make a bunch of top 100 lists this year. No, I don't. Who knows with Duquette? I don't know. It's very possible that the window has been a little slammed shut on their fingers between the Machado injury and Weeder's regressing with the bat a little bit. And, the pitching, whether it's Gausman scuffling a little bit last year, Bundy's surgery, just haven't quite come together for them. And obviously the Yankees reloaded at least a little bit. So the AL East is going to be a dogfight again. We know this, but I do kind of wonder. They need a DH. Dave Cameron wrote about this at Fangraphs either, I think this morning, that they've got, major holes on that team, and that, if Ike Davis can be even an average player, he's replacing a replacement level player in Baltimore. Now, is that worth Eduardo Rodriguez? Are they at the right spot in the win curve? I just don't know. I don't. I mean, it seems like a bad deal from the Orioles' point of view, unless they have a pro scout that sees something or a coach that sees something and thinks they can fix with Davis. But I think, like we said last week, when we talked about Ike Davis, talk about Ike Davis every week. Sandy, they have 3 more years of control. The guy that has, more power than probably anybody else on the 40-man roster, probably anyone else in the system. You can take him and roll the dice and send Duda to AAA or use him as a bench piece. You have, or see how things play out in the spring. People get hurt, it happens. You have, Alderson, he doesn't have to trade him. I mean, it seems like he has to trade him because they've talked about trading him, but he doesn't have to trade him.
You're right, and they probably will. I mean, if I had to, bet the farm on any circumstance, I'd say probably they hold on to him and bring the camp, and Duda probably goes to Las Vegas, and they roll with that crew. But I think you hit on a point, and this is, I mean, I made this point way back at the beginning of the offseason that I felt like the Orioles, their window sort of is closing, and they have sort of a discrepancy between their current assets and their future assets, where there's sort of like a gap there where Bundy is not quite there yet. Gausman, like you said, wasn't really ready. And a guy like Eduardo Rodriguez, 20, he just reached Double A this year, but he probably needs some more time there before anywhere else. And, you know, their major league assets are getting very, very close to free agency between Wieters and Hardy and Markakis.
I don't even know if we count Markakis as an asset anymore, but
fair point. But the point remains that the sort of what makes them is going to be disappearing pretty soon. And, you know, is it going to be a one step forward, one step back sort of situation by hanging on to these guys and, you know, reloading for the future while you're, you know, sort of setting yourself back a little bit by letting these guys go? So, you know, I could see a situation where they trade Rodriguez. Is it for one of these guys, one of the Mets' first basemen? I don't know. I mean, I don't know exactly how it happens, if it's necessarily for Rodriguez, but I sort of think that a trade between these two teams is, I mean, like I said, from early in the offseason, I felt like there was a match here between the Mets and Orioles, and I could sort of see it happening. I'm still optimistic about some sort of trade being worked out between the two.
Now, I do think Sandy's doing the right thing by, at least for the time being, holding steady with, you know, Eduardo Rodriguez or Tyler Thornburg or whatever top pitching prospect, Kingham over in Pittsburgh, that he's been looking for. Because it's like it's the whole thing when Cano is asking for $300 million. You're not asking for $300 million expecting to get $300 million, but you're sort of bar raising. So you're setting the level where it's like, if you get $240 million, the team thinks, and they know they didn't get a great deal, but they think, okay, we didn't spend $300 million. It's like a little psychological trick.
Yeah, and like we've said, it's been working. I mean, Sandy asks for the moon, and to this point, he's sort of gotten it in many of the deals that he's made. So, you know, I don't blame him for asking for the moon.
No, certainly, if you know, gotten it more often than not. Our next email is from Steven. Hi, Jeffrey and Co. Thanks again for the podcast. Hope you'll be reading this in the coming week, because your holiday break almost... Look, you know, I mean, I get it. Yes, we're back on a weekly schedule. I'm sorry we took the holidays off. I didn't plan on taking the holiday. I would have done a podcast on Christmas Eve if I could have found someone. I would have probably not been a good podcast. I was hammered for most of Christmas Eve. But just want to continue on a topic started last week. Rob thought the Strat-O-Matic is for old people. He would know. So how about those computer-based simulation games? Baseball Mogul, Out of the Park. As a geek, I've played my fair share of those myself. And while I like the simplicity of Baseball Mogul better, OOTP is, in my opinion, the best simulation game around these days. Thoughts? Steven C. I know people out there that swear by Out of the Park. I can't even do, like, rotisserie fantasy baseball anymore because I have no attention span. MTV generation, you know, I can't do it. I can't even like draft an AL only fantasy team and set my lineup once a week. I do franchise mode a bunch on my old PlayStation 2 for like the MLB The Show games, but I have like a wife now who would frown upon that probably. And also I'm like an adult. I should get out of the house and do things. I have considered What If Sports. So that punches like the few left brain buttons that I have and requires less time commitment. How about you, Rob? Any of these tickle your fancy?
No, I mean, I sort of hinted on it last week. Maybe it's not necessarily that they're for old people. I don't know. I never had a mind for them, I guess. I mean, I was always just fixated on more orthodox video games. So, I mean, I guess we can sort of bring the discussion into that territory. I was big on growing up on, like, you know, MLB The Show. Before that, we can talk about, like, hey, go back to NES and RBI Baseball. That was a hell of a game.
Quality game.
How about Baseball Simulator. Were you familiar with that one?
No.
Where it was like a futuristic baseball where there was like robots and powers.
What?
And like you had to like use your power-ups throughout the games very strategically. It was a Baseball Simulator 3000, I think it was called, or was it 2000? But I mean, trust me, look, it was a good one. I think that was a Sega baseball game. Okay. That was a good one.
What did I play? Something I played on Sega Genesis over and over again. So I don't remember what it was.
Robert Clemens baseball was like sort of good. That was NES though again.
Yeah, RBI baseball. I have it on like the Wii Arcade, and my wife constantly beats me at it because it's like the one video game she's really good at. It was a Genesis game I played constantly when I was a kid. Now I'm trying to see if I can find it. I don't think it was Tony La Russa baseball. Was it World Series baseball? It might have been World Series baseball. Yeah. I played a lot. Yeah, I can see. I can tell by the box on Wikipedia. I played a lot of World Series baseball.
I don't think I know that one. That's interesting. Here's a sneaky good one for you. Little League Baseball. I think it was like the Little League World Series video game on NES. Sneaky good game.
I played a lot of... There was a... It was an English port of a Japanese game. They didn't port very well. But there was a baseball game. I think it might have just been called Baseball for the original Game Boy that I played a lot of when I was a kid, too.
Baseball.
I have, and of course, this is a thing that exists. I'm on Wikipedia right now looking at chronology of baseball video games.
Oh, there you go. So, I mean, you can really break it down.
Yeah, they have everything. Are you thinking of Super Baseball 2020? No, you're thinking of Super Baseball Simulator 1000.
Yeah, that may have been it. I might be dropping the Super, but it was definitely Baseball Simulator.
Yeah. There's also a baseball series. This one was for the NES or the SNES?
No, I think probably NES. I didn't have an SNES.
Then it was just Baseball Simulator 1000.
Okay, that makes sense. I switched from NES over to Genesis.
A Game Boy. I don't seem to have listed my... I didn't have Ken Griffey Jr. baseball. Now we're into Game Boy Color. That's too far. I'm like reliving my adolescence here. Roger Clemens, MVP baseball. That's all SNES and NES. I do also play Old Hoss 1K884 baseball simulator, if that counts.
I don't even know what that is.
Somebody, Old Hoss Radburn on Twitter made a joke about back on one of the show games, kind of about the Old Hoss 1K884 baseball game, and somebody created it. It's like a little, it's just like a point click. You have like, you pick from options that are throw a strike, throw a ball, throw it in the batsman's head, aim for the numbers, throw at the legs of the batsman, and then it like generates an outcome. So it's like one of those old, really, really old type early computer baseball simulators type thing.
I'm going to have to look into this.
Yes, I'll send you the link. It's pretty fun to kill time every once in a while. I think you can actually win by forfeit if you maim or injure or kill enough of the opposing players.
I love the internet and that it makes things like that possible.
Yeah.
Apparently there was a Koshien baseball game. And Koshien is like, for those who don't know, don't follow Japanese baseball, it's like the massively popular high school baseball tournament.
Yes.
Old in Japan, and like that's where players like Yu Darvish and Daisuke Matsuzaka like sort of build their legend by, you know, throwing like 250 pitches in their Koshien game. And they made a video game out of it. I missed that one.
Was that an import? Would that even get released here?
Maybe that's the problem. Maybe it never made it over here. Hmm. And it's sort of like, I mean, just looking at the box, it looks like a mix of like a baseball game, and then like a Pokemon game. Actually pretty awesome. I'm sort of sad that they didn't bring it over here.
Well, there's a... It's that one that came out for the Wii that's considered to be pretty good. That's like a Japanese port. I don't remember. I haven't gotten it, but...
Yeah, sadly, I sort of dropped out of video gaming after, I guess, early Xbox. Suspiciously, around the time that I met my wife, and then suddenly my video game playing sort of dropped off. So, like, the show I'm not as big on as most people, and I haven't played it in probably 5 years or more.
Yeah, I don't know what my last one was. Probably one of the last PS2 ones. Our next email is from Ahmed Rosario, apparently. You know, I know this is like a thing, especially in Prospect Land. I see all the time in Keith Law chats and Perspectives chats where people, you know, pretend to be the players they're asking about and a question like that. But
so you're whatever. Saying that the Mets' top 10 prospect didn't send us an email?
Well, I mean, they're committed to it because the email address is ahmed.rosario1@gmail.com, which seems credible to me. The question is the Mets shortstop issue. Any chance a long shot prospect gets a chance? I'm going to guess not Ahmed Rosario, though.
Well, Ahmed.
I assume, I'm just going to pretend that they're trolling me about my write-up of Ahmed Rosario. But
if they are, good for them.
Yeah, that's like really going deep. I'll play along. I don't think Wilfredo Tovar counts. Because I think he's, you know, we know what he is. How about Matt Reynolds? I don't know that I believe this, but how about Matt Reynolds?
He's going to be your long shot prospect?
He'll probably start the year in AA. Reports on his defense have improved. He looked not good at shortstop when I saw him in Savannah in 2012. But it was right after he was drafted and he hadn't played much shortstop. His last couple of years of college. I'm not entirely sure he'll hit enough, but the swing's not bad. I mean, he's not going to hit for power, so if he can actually play shortstop, that helps the bat out. I this is very half-hearted, but you know, maybe he figures something out at AA and hits 280 with some walks and subpar defense. I mean, isn't that kind of what Gavin Cecchini is going to be? In a weird way, again, this is kind of like, I don't necessarily believe this, but I mean, yeah. He's going to get to AA, so I don't know. Matt Reynolds, I guess.
That's as half-hearted an endorsement as I've ever heard.
I mean, at least as far as, you know, 2014 goes, I think I was the last believer in Phil Evans, and even I'm off that bandwagon now. He's also not a shortstop. I can see the Mets doing something crazy. I want to say crazy. What kind of crazy? I see the Mets doing something crazy and moving Dilson Herrera back to shortstop. Not back to shortstop. Moving Dilson Herrera to shortstop in St. Lucie this year. Because they did it with Reynolds. They're not afraid to move guy. I mean, they kept Flores as a shortstop for a while. And Herrera certainly has better physical tools, athletic tools, outside of his arm, which is the reason he's a second baseman. But, you know, Evans' arm certainly isn't great, and they play him at shortstop. Same with Cecchini. So, I don't know. Not really. There's no good answer here. We know this. We talk to the Shortstop Avenue Audio. There's no good answer here.
Yeah, the Mets do not have any... I won't say they don't have any good shortstop prospects. They don't have any close shortstop prospects, so that really, unfortunately, probably is not going to happen. Sorry, Ahmed.
So, here's something that happened, Rob. While we were recording, we got another email. And normally, I would just kick it to next week. I've done no prep for it. And it's something that I should really probably do research for. But it's from our friend Randy Brandt. So, we're gonna plow ahead and finish this up.
What would a podcast be without an email from Randy Brandt?
Gentlemen, you're in charge of the team. This is great. This is so like, oh, this is going to be a total shit show. But let's do it anyway. We'll plow ahead. Gentlemen, you're in charge of the 2014 Mets. You have all the players available to you that are currently on the major league team, minor league teams, and the free agents signed during the offseason. You also have Kevin Mitchell after the 86 season. My question for you is, what do you do with Mr. Mitchell? 1. Make him a regular in the lineup. What positions? 2. Bench platoon player. 3. Send him to Vegas. Not sure he had any options to be sent to AAA. It's a good question. We got to get to call up, send a tweet out to TPG Mets. Did Kevin Mitchell have options going into the 87 season? Trade him like the Mets did back in 86 based on today's teams. What teams would you target? What players would you try to get? 5. None of the above. Another option. Thank you for this amazing podcast, for a wonderful, enjoyable in 2014. All right, Rob, say some things about Kevin Mitchell while I furiously look him up on Baseball Reference.
I wouldn't trade him because, I mean, I think we all remember him as like a very colorful character on the Mets who went on to better things, but I'm not sure if everyone realizes what better things he went on to. And hey,
I guess we have like the foreknowledge of what he's going to turn into, or are we just going based on...
I have foreknowledge. I mean, I don't know if I can play that game of not knowing. I mean, at that point, I was in diapers, so it's hard for me to visualize.
But I mean, even after the 86 season, he was 25% better than league average as a hitter. And he hit .277, .344, .466. You know, playing his home games in Shea Stadium in the mid-80s.
And he had tools galore. At least the power was outstanding. And you could see it just by watching him walk through the door in a baseball uniform that he could hit a ball a long way.
The funny thing is, he never hit for a ton of power as a prospect. He could handle the stick, certainly. Again, looking at the way teams handled prospects in the early 80s is not particularly instructive. It was very, very different. But I mean, yeah, I think you've got a guy who at his age 24 season, you know, kind of played all over the diamond. We know he had defensive issues. Though when he was young, he was still an okay defender. It wasn't until he got, you know, slightly older and slightly fatter that it started to be a real issue. And I don't even know if he qualifies as a butcher in left field. He wasn't good, certainly. But yeah, I mean, I just find a place to play him. You know, first base, maybe? You know, I'll put it this way to you, Rob. If either... Yeah, I mean, I guess we're kind of back into an era now where offensive levels are more in line with what they were in the mid-80s. Would you sign up for... We'll use his... 1987 season. Would you sign up right now from either Duda or Davis for a .280, .350, .474 line with 22 homers?
I think you absolutely have to.
Yeah, and I think that's what you run into with Mitchell. I think you just find it's tough to put him at first base because he's 5'10".
Really? Wow, well, he's like a fire hydrant.
He definitely played some first base throughout his career, and you saw more short first baseman, shortish, like 6-foot first baseman in the 80s than you do today. You see almost none that are like 6 foot, 6'1 or shorter, basically. I actually looked this up when I was doing a little project related to Dominic Smith. I mean, I guess if I had 1986 Kevin Mitchell going into this past offseason, I probably don't sign Chris Young.
Yeah, I think he sort of gives you that like potentially 25 home run guy who you're not quite sure what he is, but you know that the ability is there. He's shown it to you in flashes in the past. So I think he sort of fills that role.
I mean, yes. Yeah, I guess he's a right-handed hitter. You just find places for him to play. I mean, he was a pretty good prospect. The guy that hit really well for that 86 team looking back now. You know, it's tough to... I'm kind of like trying in my head sort of project what kind of player he'd be in this era, probably a little more high strikeout guy with a little more power, a little less batting average, and a few more walks just to sort of adjust for era. I mean, the guy could handle a stick. He's a career 280 hitter for a guy that you associate mostly as a power hitter. I mean, he hit 280, 360, 520 for his career.
Dude's got a 47 home run season on under the belt.
Yeah, and a couple other 30 home run years. So, you know, basically if you look at his peak, we'll say from 26 to 32, he was worth, I can do math. He was worth about 28 wins. You know, he was worth, you know, he's at 30 wins for his career. He had a very, very nice major league career. You know, made a couple All-Star games, won an MVP. Silver Slugger, yeah, I'd take that guy any day of the week. And he was third in Rookie of the Year voting after the 86 season, playing only 100 games.
Yeah, definitely weird. I mean, again, I wasn't around at the time, so I don't know what was in play here. But, I mean, the fact that they traded him for another outfielder who was older in Kevin McReynolds, I mean, who had plenty of prior performance to sort of point to. I mean, he had a couple of 20 home run seasons under his belt already. I mean, he got some down ballot MVP votes in 84. I mean, a guy worth, you know, trading for, but older, less years of cost control, and, you know,
plays. I mean, to be fair, that was less of an issue in that era, certainly.
Yeah, true, but I mean, still, it's weird. I mean, he plays the same position, so, I mean, not as if there was another hole that they filled. They filled the same hole that they created by trading Mitchell. I don't get it.
I mean, it worked out, sort of, for both teams. I mean, McReynolds had a very good Mets career.
Yeah, I mean, he went on to hit, you know, 29 home runs that first season in 87, 27 the next year, 22, 24. I mean, he was a very useful player. But you sort of wouldn't mind having that peak of Mitchell's career back.
Yeah, I mean, if you're in this, I'm trying to think what a comparable trade would be today. It'd be like trading Kevin Mitchell for, I don't know, maybe, let's keep it with the Padres, actually. Maybe, I don't know if I want to use Will Venable. Do I want to use Will Venable? Yeah.
Different style hitters.
Yeah, and Venable's older. That doesn't really work. Someone that was like roughly McReynolds' age. Yeah, I don't really have a good...
Here, I got one. How about in terms of trading, like, sort of a young spark plug offensive player who's, you know, not really established himself yet, and sort of the return that he's bringing back? How about Avisail Garcia? White Sox traded for him earlier in the offseason. Tigers got back Jose Iglesias. So, say you're holding on to Kevin Mitchell, knowing the Mets' current need for a shortstop, do you trade him for Jose Iglesias?
Man, I love Jose Iglesias, but I didn't really... I understand why the Tigers made that deal. I don't think they make that deal if Peralta doesn't get suspended. So I think circumstances kind of dictated that for them.
Yeah, again, it's hard to play this game because we know what's coming with Mitchell, but I think that's probably the best I can do in terms of sort of a current comparable scenario. And you look at the return and it's like, well, certainly useful. I mean, the Mets would love a player like Iglesias right now in terms of their current needs. He fills them and then some. But, yeah, tough to let that guy go. And plus, he was a hell of a fighter, so you're losing that too.
It's true. And the Mets, Kevin Mitchell would probably, I mean, he wouldn't be prospect eligible, but would have been one of the better Mets position prospects in the current day system.
Oh, yeah, I mean, based on what he had already done at the major league level, he'd be at the top of the list.
Yeah.
But seriously, look up Kevin Mitchell fights. They're epic. The guy, you didn't want to step to him.
I think that went better than I expected, actually.
Well done, Randy.
Good question. We managed to not make a complete and utter hash of that. So well done to us too. That wraps up this week's edition of Maze and Avenue Audio, because there's nothing left to discuss.
No others came in during
let's just make one last check.
We could do this all night.
Yeah, no, we're clear. This is not going to turn into a live call-in show. That's my one promise for 2014.
Damn.
Actually, I will. I don't know if I'm speaking out of school here, but had an offer to turn this into a live call-in show.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's not going to happen. For a variety of reasons, I'm just not that organized. As you can tell by our rather slipshod agenda the last 2 weeks.
Oh, another dream out the window.
Yeah, sorry, Rob. There's always... Okay, now I'm going to be good. So this has been Amazing Avenue Audio, the official podcast of your SB Nation New York Mets site, Amazing Avenue. You can find us on the interwebs at AmazingAvenue.com, on Twitter at Amazing Avenue, and on Facebook at facebook.com/ Amazing Avenue fans. And according to one Eric Simon, we're now also on Friendster and its little like tilde thing, Amazing Avenue. I don't think we're actually on Friendster. I think he might have been pulling my leg.
It sounds made up, but I could very easily be out of the loop here.
I don't know. I think it's made up. I don't think we're well on. Well done, Eric. Set up the MySpace page next, though. Get on that, seriously. I want to be one of those like tiling backgrounds of Sandy Alderson that doesn't really properly move as you scroll down the MySpace profile like everyone had in 2005.
You know who didn't?
Probably you.
Bingo.
Yeah, shocker there. Because you were still on Friendster, most likely.
Probably. I knew it sounded familiar.
Oh, where in the world was I? You can find the podcast on iTunes. Search for Amazing Avenue Audio. You can listen or subscribe right there. I encourage you to subscribe and also to rate and review the podcast. You also find us on the Stitcher app and probably do the same thing there, I assume. Stitcher app is still a mystery to me. I've done nothing to actually inform my discussion of the Stitcher app on this podcast, nor will I. So Stitcher app people, do your Stitcher app things. You also directly download the podcast from MazonAvenueAudio.com. Listen to the embedded player that goes up in the podcast post at Amazon Avenue proper. My co-host this week is Rob Castellano. You can find him on Twitter at @_Robcast. I'm your host, Jeffrey Paternostro. You can find me on Twitter at Jeff Paternostro. Anything interesting coming up this week, Rob?
I'm feeling pretty confident that I'm going to be hooked on watching Kevin Mitchell beating down Sammy Khalifa for a couple nights. So I've got that going.
You got that going for you. I have theoretically started a piece about prospects I'm looking forward to hearing from or seeing or just seeing what they do in 2014.
Oh, I look forward to it.
And I started writing it this week and I just have no, it wasn't working for me, but we'll see how it goes. Just haven't quite a little bit of writer's block lately for whatever reason.
Yeah, actually I've been feeling the same, but I had a brief lapse of productivity this weekend. And so this morning posted a story about the Mets' atrocious leadoff situation. So go ahead and check that out.
It really should just be two words, Josh Satin, problem solved. I know it has to be 150, but Josh Satin 75 times would work too.
He made a cameo in there, I'll say that.
Oh, of course. So that's it for episode 48. Somehow we got, as we are wont to do, got an hour and a half out of absolutely no content. So cheers to us, and we'll probably do the same thing next week on Amazing Avenue Audio, episode 49.